Good morning. Creative projects are starting to pour in. I can't say they're pouring in terribly because I've only got a few, but they're starting. So a few people have turned them in. That's good. Remember, you only have to do one creative project, right? So people who have projects on that cart now are relieved of that whole problem the rest of the term, right? The rest of you, if you don't have a project on that cart or in my office, then you've got to be thinking about this next term probably, and the next third, and what you're going to do, how you're going to put together some sort of a creative project. So don't let it slide. Don't forget about it. Also, don't forget that there's an assignment due tomorrow again, a reading assignment for you to do and get to me. So those are all the announcement-y kinds of things I can think of. So where have we been? Where are we going? We finished up looking at the circulatory system last time and really looking at the regulation of blood sugar level as kind of a topic, kind of tangentially related to the circulatory system, but it's blood sugar is really, really important. So that's where I put it. We saw that regulation of blood sugar is under very careful homeostatic control. And in fact, there are a couple of different systems, if you want to think about it that way, that are involved in helping to regulate blood sugar level. We saw that the sensors are in the pancreas, and those little islet cells, those little islets of Langerhans, that's where we're monitoring blood sugar level. And we saw there were two different kinds of cells, the alpha cells and beta cells, that are actually sensitive to blood sugar level, and depending on whether the level's higher or lower, they're going to produce more or less of their own particular hormones. Alpha cells producing glucagon, beta cells producing insulin. And that, then, is the way of communicating with the effectors, right? So the sensor's in one place, the effector's somewhere else, and they're communicating by means of these hormones that they're releasing. And we saw the effects of the hormones. The glucagon, if the blood sugar gets too low, the glucagon, more and more glucagon in there, it will activate a series of reactions in the liver. And I added just a little bit here because I thought maybe that was important to put in there. We generally, when we think of ATP, this is something, again, from last term, we think of energy and using it. I mean, almost anything that we do that requires energy, we use that ATP molecule in order to generate it. But it turns out that ATP is used for other things too, and it's a signaling molecule. Many, 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 many of these pathways that operate, like I showed you how glucagon operates, uses ATP, and what they do is they'll take that ATP and they'll actually cut off two of the three phosphates. And when we talked about using ATP for energy last term, we talked about cleaving that third phosphate, knocking it off, and getting a lot of energy from that that we can use to make other things happen, like your muscles move and your heart pump and all that kind of stuff. And signaling, it knocks off two of those, so we wind up with a laser pointer that doesn't want to work, and we wind up with AMP, adenosine monophosphate, and actually it gets connected around. It's called cyclic AMP, cyclic adenosine monophosphate, and that is a signaling molecule in the cell that gets used. Hello. Okay, now we're stuck on it. That gets used a lot in these pathways. And it's that cyclic AMP then that activates other reactions, and you get this kind of cascading effect. And eventually, you get down to the reaction that you're looking for. In this case, increasing the breakdown of glycogen. So there's one set of enzymes that would be involved in doing that, breaking that glycogen down and releasing the glucose so that more glucose can be put into the blood. And then another set of enzymes that are involved in the gluconeogenesis. So it's activating both of those. So here we're producing new glucose, right, that's going out into the blood. That's helping to keep our blood sugar levels up. So again, it's a very, very common pathway route that we find in cells for a lot of different things, especially hormones where they're binding to a receptor on the outside of the cell. So when the blood sugar level goes down, more glucagon in the circulating in the blood, liver then begins to release more glucose. So we're stimulating glycogen breakdown, we're stimulating gluconeogenesis, and that glucose is then going to move over into the blood and help to maintain some level of glucose in the blood, even though we're not maybe taking any glucose in. So that was one leg of the pathway. The other leg was, well, what happens after the meal when your blood sugar level gets too high? We talked about the beta cells releasing insulin. And the three target tissues for insulin, not just one, but three. And I tried to, remember, it has two different effects. I tried to box those off, the tissues with their effect. So one effect was to increase the permeability of glucose into the skeletal muscle and the fat cells. So that was one effect. So that's going to remove glucose from the blood. And the other effect was to increase glycogen synthesis by the liver cells and the muscle and skeletal muscle cells. That's going to reduce the level of glucose in the blood too. So if it's too high, insulin's going to help, going to signal to bring it down. If it's too low, glucagon's going to signal to bring it back up again. So that's our homeostatic control pathway there. And that's how we maintain blood sugar levels. Now, there are problems. I mentioned I want you to be sure and look in the lecture note packet on those pages, because there are some explanations of diabetes and hypoglycemia, both problems with insulin levels or insulin receptor levels. And you can see some of the different things that go on there if the insulin levels aren't behaving themselves. If the pancreas isn't producing enough insulin, if the pancreas is producing too much insulin, that can have effects on the body. Or if there aren't enough insulin receptors on the cells that they're targeting, that will affect how much activity that insulin that's being produced can have, and so forth. So be sure that you look at those in the lecture notes. Okay, so maintaining that blood sugar level was one example. In just a minute, I'm going to give you another example of homeostasis in the body as it relates to the respiratory system. But we started last time looking at the respiratory system. I plan on finishing that up today and actually moving on to the next system today also. Function was gas exchange. We have to be able to get oxygen in, get rid of carbon dioxide. So that was the gas exchange. Happens in the lungs. By the way, this is what lungs look like. Now, you've all been in lab. You've all had the opportunity to open up your fetal pigs and so forth. And you may have realized or noticed that the lungs in the fetal pig are very, very small. Very, very small. That's because they haven't been expanded yet, right? The pig was not born, never took this first breath. You know how you can tell if a child that's found dead ever was died prior to birth as opposed to after birth? You just take a little piece of lung tissue and put it in water and see if it floats or not. If those lungs have been expanded once, then the density is much lighter and it'll float. If the lungs haven't been expanded, it's going to sink to the bottom. So, you know, if you're ever called on to do that, you're going to be. Anyway, that's how you tell. Well, now, this is an adult pig lung. Okay, adult pig lung, you can see the heart was in here. The heart's kind of missing right now. But adult pig lung that's been dried down. And you'll be able to look at this in lab. The tiny air sacs that I talked about are just throughout this lung. In fact, so much is dried down. If you pick it up, it's incredibly light. It feels like styrofoam. I've had people say, oh, come on, that's really not a real lung, is it? That's just a model. No, this is a real lung that's been dried down. In fact, I'm pretty convinced people who came up with styrofoam probably studied lungs first. Oh, that's cool. You know, we'll make a real light material and we'll call it styrofoam instead of lungifoam. Yeah. So you can take a look at this in lab and see the origins are here. Probably not, but that's my interpretation. So we were looking at this, and so we talked about gas pressure, right? And you want to be sure that you can you understand this, and you're able to do some of the manipulations that I showed you how to do last time. We talked about air and how air is, what, about 21% oxygen? That's what we want, right? It's about 78% nitrogen. We don't care about that. It's just kind of a filler. Although, if you're a scuba diver, you care about it because that nitrogen actually gets dissolved into your blood. And if you come up from depth too fast, those bubbles will form, and it'll kill you, nitrogen narcosis. So that's a concern, but for most of us, that's not a big deal. A very, very tiny amount of carbon dioxide, some water vapor, all sorts of things in that make up the air. We talked about normal atmospheric pressure, which is the air column, the weight of the air column forcing down on you, which we're all born into and used to, so we don't even feel. You know, it's like, what are you talking about? It's actually a tremendous amount of weight that's pressing down. What is the number? Oh, I don't have the number here. Anyway, it's a tremendous amount of weight that's pressing down on us because of the air column. And so we measure atmospheric pressure, right? And we talked about how we measure that. And at sea level, under what we call standard conditions, kind of average conditions, about 760 millimeters of mercury is the standard atmospheric pressure. And as you go up in elevation, that reduces because there's less air column pushing down on you. So at 2,000 feet in Ashland, the standard atmospheric pressure would be lower than 760. At 10,000 feet up on a tall mountain, it would be even lower than that. And I got to tell you, one of the funny things that the weather forecasters do, if you listen to weather forecasts, they're always talking about atmospheric, barometric pressure, right? This is the barometric pressure. If it's dropping, there's a storm coming. If it's going up, then sunny weather's coming, high pressure. When there's nothing going on, high pressure areas will kind of block other areas, and you get maybe a lot of heat from that or whatever. So as to not confuse the populace, weather forecasters kind of standardize these whole things. So they would say, they would look you in the face and say, I know 760 is atmospheric pressure at sea level. Well, we're going to call that atmospheric pressure at 2,000 feet in Ashland too. Okay, so they kind of standardize everything to altitude. They kind of take out that altitude figure. And so you can see, you can compare the atmospheric pressure, say, on the coast with the atmospheric pressure inland, and you're not having to correct for altitude and things like that. So be aware, they do little tricks like that, but really if we were to measure the atmospheric pressure here, we would not be seeing 760. We'd probably be, we'd be seeing something a little bit less than 760 as our standard pressure. We talked about how that air is composed of all the different gases, and we talked about partial pressures. Again, the reason I talk with you about partial pressures is it gives us a way to compare things, to compare pressures so that we can figure out, is the gas going to move in, is it going to move out, which way is it going to move? So we want to know what's the contribution of oxygen to that air pressure. And remember, it was simply the percent of that gas in the total mixture. So if oxygen is 21%, then 21% of that 760 is the contribution of oxygen. And that's what we call the partial pressure of oxygen. And we looked at the partial pressures here. And saw that at atmospheric air at sea level and so forth, so that the partial pressure of oxygen was about 157 millimeters of mercury, and the partial pressure of carbon dioxide is about 0.3 millimeters of mercury. So if you're down at the beach on an average day running around, that's what you would be breathing in. We also at the end last time talked about how because we tend in any given breath to not exchange the full, in fact, I think it would be almost impossible to exchange the full amount of air that you have in your lungs in any given breath. I don't think you can possibly force it all out and then bring more in. But at rest, especially sitting here taking notes, all excited about what I'm talking about, probably panting and stuff, you're only exchanging like 10% of that air, right? And so we're constantly pulling oxygen out of that air that's in the lungs, but we're only exchanging about 10%. That means that if we sampled that air in the lungs, we'd find much less percent contribution of oxygen. And you have a table in the lecture notes that we looked at. It's like, 13.2% oxygen in the alveolar air, that composition. because we're drawing that oxygen in, but a much higher contribution of carbon dioxide, 5.3% of the alveolar air is carbon dioxide. So those are the conditions that our bodies have to function under, regardless of what we're drawing in and so forth. Now, what happens when you exercise? Okay, if you're out there exercising hard, besides the fact that we know that your heart rate's going to go up, right? We talked about that. What's going to happen with your respiration? Yeah, it's going to go up, right? So you're going to start breathing more frequently, taking more frequent breaths. What else about those breaths? They're going to be deeper, aren't they? You're going to be drawing more air in. You're going to be forcing more air out. Now, never 100% again, but you'll be doing a whole lot more than that 10% that we talked about. So what would you expect to happen to the concentration of oxygen and carbon dioxide in your alveolar air as you exercise? Any ideas? You'd expect it to go up. Which is going to go up?
Your concentration.
Which one? Oxygen, both oxygen and CO2? Could be. I'm just trying to figure out what
they're coming in and out equally. Almost.
Yeah. Okay. So. So I think if you're breathing more frequently, if you're breathing more deeply and so forth, you're going to be bringing more oxygen in, aren't you? And you're going to be getting rid of more carbon dioxide as you do that. Is that reasonable? Please say yes. That is reasonable. Okay. Thank you. So you have a graph that I'd like for you to look at over on page 38. Now, what we're seeing here on this graph is activity level. Okay, so, and it's measured by oxygen consumption. The more active you are, the more oxygen you're going to consume per minute. So, the higher the oxygen consumption, the greater your activity level. So, we're seeing that on the x-axis. On the y-axis is just partial pressure, the things that we've been talking about. One of the striking things, I think, about this is look at this line for alveolar partial pressure of oxygen. Okay, so we're measuring the PO2 of oxygen in the alveolus. Okay, here we are at rest. That's what we've been talking about. It's right around 100 millimeters mercury. Even at really high, okay, we've increased our oxygen consumption by sevenfold here. We're out there really hitting the pavement or something. It only goes up to about 110. Okay, so it's fairly flat, that line, for alveolar PO2. Even though you're breathing faster, you're breathing harder, you're bringing more oxygen in, of course you're using more oxygen out of that more frequently too, right? And look what happens to the alveolar PCO2, the carbon dioxide level in the alveolar air. There we are, starting at about 40 that we talked about. It dips a little bit, it might dip down to about 35, which means we're actually getting rid of a little bit more carbon dioxide than we were when we weren't exercising. We're generating a tremendous amount more of carbon dioxide, and yet we're not seeing much of a change in the alveolar air. Okay, this again, homeostasis. Our bodies are responding to what's going on, and we're maintaining relatively constant levels. So you could say, okay, the set point for PO2 must be around 100. And as we breathe more air in, as we breathe it in more frequently, we're doing it in response to maintain that level, right? Similar to down here, the PCO2, the partial pressure for CO2 set point must be around 40. And it's actually, we'll get into this in a few minutes, but your rate of breathing has really nothing to do with the oxygen level in your blood. It's all carbon dioxide. That's what you're monitoring. And we'll come back to that in a little while. So, another example of homeostasis, where you would expect the oxygen levels to go way up because you're breathing so much harder and bringing more in. You expect CO2 levels maybe to go down. They don't. It maintains a relatively constant state. Okay. Now, What does this all mean? If we were to look at, well, let's make a little drawing here, okay? I think it's time. So find a place to make a drawing, maybe the back of the page 37 or something. So here's, this is a single alveolus that I'm trying to draw here, okay? Remember, we looked at this last time, my chart, looked at this, and how these alveoli are kind of rounded air sacs, blind air sacs at the end of the bronchioles, bronchii, and then they're surrounded by capillary beds. That's where a gas exchange is occurring. These alveoli are only like a cell thick. Okay, so they're kind of fragile too, but that's what they are. So this is a single alveolus, okay? And this is continuous with the outside. This is, we're going to breathe in, we're going to breathe out. This is the alveolar air that we've been talking about is in here. And we've talked about how the PO2 in here is going to be about 100 millimeters of mercury, and that the PCO2 is going to be about 40 millimeters of mercury. And we've seen now that it's going to be like that whether we're laying on the couch watching TV or we're out exercising. That's going to be maintained pretty constant. Yeah, you had a question?
Sorry, what does the P represent?
Partial pressure. So it's actually pressure, but it's partial pressure. So that's the contribution of that particular gas to the total. And by putting it into these terms, by the millimeters mercury, it gives us that comparison ability now. Okay, so surrounding this alveolus are the capillary beds, right? So I'm just going to draw a capillary here. It's going to be kind of surrounding. Notice I left a little space for the interstitial fluid, so all this is going to happen through the medium of the interstitial fluid. So believe it or not, that's a capillary. So we got blood flowing in, we've got blood flowing out. This would be let's call this the arterial end, since we got the blood coming in this end, that would be a good idea. And this would be the venous end, the venule end, where it's going to be flowing out from the lung. Now, what do we see? What does typical blood entering the lung look like? Okay, we've seen what the air in the alveolus looks like. What does typical blood coming into the lung look like? And that typical blood is going to have a PO2 of about 40. PO2 of about 40, and that reflects the fact that as that blood circulated around the body, a lot of that oxygen has been given off into the body tissues, right, to be used for aerobic respiration, cellular respiration. It's going to have a PCO2, so that the level of carbon dioxide in the blood is going to be about 45 millimeters of mercury. Again, reflecting the fact that you've been metabolizing, giving off carbon dioxide, it's being picked up by the blood, and it's being circulated around. When that blood hits the lung, specifically gets into the alveoli, what's going to happen then? As this blood is flowing through, which way is oxygen going to move? Into the blood or out of the blood? It's going to move into it, right? It's always going to move from where the pressure's higher to where the pressure's lower. So oxygen is going to move in. And in fact, by the time this blood is exiting the alveolus, enough oxygen has entered that blood to equilibrate with the oxygen that's in the alveolus. So blood leaving here is going to have a PO2 of about 100. And I don't have room. That's 100 millimeters of mercury. Okay, so there's been enough time. This happens really quickly. Enough time for that to fully load up with oxygen. You can't get any more in because there's no more to put in. Once those numbers are equilibrated, that's it. That's the end of the movement there. Which way is carbon dioxide going to move? Out from the blood into the lung, right? So here's our CO2. That's going to move into the alveolus. And again, it's going to equilibrate. So the PCO2 leaving the lung is going to be about 40, whereas it was 45 coming in. So we've gotten rid of a significant amount of carbon dioxide. We've picked up a whole lot of oxygen on our way through the lungs. Now, the blood plasma alone doesn't have the capability to carry very much oxygen. Now, oxygen will dissolve into the plasma as a gas, and there will be a certain amount in the plasma. But when you think about the needs that we have for oxygen delivery and so forth, blood plasma alone isn't going to do the job at all. And so we use what we call respiratory pigments. Respiratory pigments. This green pen is about dead. To augment the ability to carry oxygen. And there are two primary respiratory pigments that we have in humans. One is hemoglobin. And the hemoglobin is found in the red blood cells. We've talked about how red blood cells are packed with hemoglobin. Like 35% of their dry weight is hemoglobin, right? They're just packed with hemoglobin. And the other respiratory pigment that we're going to run into in a few minutes is one called myoglobin. And the myoglobin we're going to find in muscle tissue. And it's going to be a way of kind of storing a little bit of extra oxygen in the muscle tissue so that if all of a sudden you get into one of those fight or flight situations and you got to mobilize quickly and so forth, while the while the circulatory patterns are changing, you've got an extra shot of oxygen. We'll talk about that later on. But I want to focus on the hemoglobin right now. So it's the hemoglobin that's in the red blood cells. In the capillary beds in the alveoli, the oxygen moves through the interstitial fluid into the blood plasma, and then it packs onto the red blood cells, packs onto the hemoglobin in the red blood cells. So we see a movement. It's kind of like what we saw in the liver with glucose entering, and then if we can convert that glucose into glycogen, we can just keep bringing more glucose into the cell because we're storing it away, we're no longer seeing it in the cell. The same thing's going to happen here with hemoglobin. As that oxygen moves into the cells, it's going to get loaded onto the hemoglobin, which means that we can bring more oxygen into the cell until we've fully saturated our hemoglobin. We get to that point, and then we can't bring any more oxygen into the cell. So hemoglobin, the abbreviation for hemoglobin, this pen is not working well. The abbreviation for hemoglobin is HB, so when you see that, that's what I'm talking about, it's hemoglobin. Each hemoglobin molecule. Now remember, if you think back when we've talked about hemoglobin in the past, hemoglobin is a fairly large protein that's actually composed of four subunits. Okay? Each one of those subunits has kind of at the center of it an iron atom. And it's the iron atom that the oxygen is attracted to. So it's being carried on that iron. So if you go to the doctor and they say, oh, you're deficient in iron, you have iron poor anemia or something like that, that's not good because it's the iron that's actually, iron in the hemoglobin that's actually carrying the oxygen. So you want to take care of that problem. Because there are four subunits, each subunit has an iron, that means that each hemoglobin molecule can carry as many as four oxygen molecules. So each hemoglobin molecule carries as many as four oxygen molecules. So when we talk about hemoglobin being fully loaded, that would mean that all of the hemoglobin, each one of them is carrying the four oxygen molecules. Now, the packing on, think of the loading on of the oxygen is a little complicated. The first oxygen to load on is the toughest to actually get the hemoglobin to load on because of the nature of the molecule. Once you've got the first oxygen on, then the second oxygen is a little bit easier to get on. And once you have the second on, the third's a little bit easier and so on. And then the fourth becomes even a little bit easier to load on. So it's not just a linear kind of a thing. And in fact, if we look at how oxygen loads on to a hemoglobin molecule, we get what we call an oxygen-hemoglobin association-dissociation curve. Whew. Lots of words there. And that's over on page 39. So oxygen at top 39, oxygen-hemoglobin association-dissociation curve. So this tells us how the oxygen loads onto the hemoglobin molecule under different kinds of conditions, under different partial pressures of oxygen. We want to know how much oxygen is on that hemoglobin if the partial pressure is, say, 50 millimeters mercury as opposed to 100 millimeters mercury. These are conditions we're going to find in the human body. So let's take a look at this curve. The reason this curve is S-shaped is because of what I told you about the first oxygen being the hardest to get on and the second progressively easier. So rather than a straight line, we get an S-shaped curve. This tells us for any partial pressure of oxygen, what percent is that hemoglobin going to be saturated? So if the hemoglobin on average is saturated 50%, that means that on average each hemoglobin molecule is carrying two oxygen molecules. Okay, if it's 75% saturated, then on average each hemoglobin would be carrying three oxygen molecules. 100%, then each one's carrying four oxygen molecules. So we can see this relationship now. Now remember, what was the PO2 of oxygen in the alveolar air? 100, right? Notice this table only goes up to 100. At a PO2 of 100, which is what we're getting from the alveolus, that the hemoglobin is almost 100% saturated. So that blood coming away from the lungs has just about every bit as much oxygen as you can possibly pack onto that hemoglobin. The plasma alone, if we were relying on the plasma alone to carry the oxygen, we'd only be able to carry about maybe 1%, if that much, of the oxygen that we actually carry. The hemoglobin just carries the lion's share of the oxygen. Around the body. So coming out of the lungs, PO2 of 100, that hemoglobin is just about completely saturated. You're really going to have to work hard to get it much higher because you know this is flattening off up here. Blood coming into the lungs. Okay, what did I say the PO2 of the oxygen was coming into the lungs? 40. Say, okay, wow, it's dropped from 100 to 40. That blood must really have given up a lot of its oxygen, right? Because we're down to PO2 of 40. Let's take a look at the curve. At PO2 of 40, which is right here, what's the percent saturation of hemoglobin? Well, here it is. Here's where we are, right here, right? It's about 75% saturated. Right. So there's a tremendous reserve of oxygen being carried by the hemoglobin. We've only used, on average, one of the four oxygen molecules off each of those hemoglobin molecules. So there's a tremendous reserve of oxygen being carried by the hemoglobin. And again, the reason that we're still at 75% here is the nature of this curve, how it flattens off out here, and then it gets a lot steeper. Let's say that blood starts to flow through a working muscle. Okay, so it's using a lot more oxygen as it goes through that muscle. This is where that would come into play. Let's say the PO2 of the muscle becomes drops to 30 instead of coming out of 40. How much oxygen has been given off by the hemoglobin? So we come up here. Say, okay, there's 30 right there, right? Well, at a FeO2 of 30 moved down to 60% saturation. So we've been able to pick up a lot more oxygen in that steep little drop. And if it drops to 20, we're down to about 35% saturation. Right. So when the oxygen pressure in a tissue really gets low, that hemoglobin has a tremendous reserve of oxygen that it can deliver to that tissue to help bring that back up again, to help supply that tissue with oxygen. Okay, so that describes what goes on in the blood and the hemoglobin with the oxygen. You need to know how to use that graph. So we can go either way. If we know the percent saturation of the hemoglobin, then we can say, oh, that hemoglobin must have been in a PO2 of whatever, right? So say, okay, I know that the hemoglobin was only 20% saturated. Well, I can say, okay, that must have been in an environment where the PO2 is about 15. So we can go in that direction, or we can say, okay, what if the PO2 of oxygen is 60? What's the percent saturation of the hemoglobin at 60? It's about 90%. Right, even though you dropped from 100 to 60, you've still got about 90% of the oxygen on the hemoglobin molecules. So that describes that relationship. So leaving the lungs, our hemoglobin is about 100% saturated. Right? Like I said, you're just not going to be able to get much more oxygen in there if you want to. So you say, well, how come the PO2, as you're exercising, you're breathing hard, you're breathing in more deeply and so forth, why doesn't that PO2 rise? Well, it wouldn't matter if it did. Right? You're really not going to be able to load much more, if any, oxygen onto the hemoglobin. We are designed to function under these conditions, and our body responds to that, to maintain those levels of oxygen and CO2 in the lungs. And we've seen that on that exercise graph that you looked at. So leaving the lungs 100% saturated, the oxygen then goes into the tissues where the PO2 is lower because they're constantly metabolizing and using up that oxygen. And then what will happen is that the oxygen will move from the blood plasma through the interstitial fluid into the tissues where resupplying with oxygen. As the oxygen moves out of the blood plasma, then it's going to start to unload off of the hemoglobin molecules to resupply that oxygen that was in the blood plasma that's now gone and so forth. So we'll offload that oxygen in that manner to supply the oxygen to the tissue. So the hemoglobin gives up its oxygen to a certain extent, comes back around, gets repacked, reloaded, and then just continue that cycle around and around. Even when it returns to the lungs, remember, it's still, on average, 75% saturated. So we've still got that tremendous reserve sitting there. Questions about that? Yeah?
So, lung cancer,
this efficient exchange depends upon access of the oxygen through this layer of cells in the alveolus and being able to diffuse into the blood. The more fluid you have laying on that surface, the slower the rate of diffusion is. And so the less, you're not going to be able to perfuse it completely. You're going to start dropping in the PO2 level of the blood. Altitude sickness is another example. You know, when people go to extreme high altitudes without acclimating along the way, even if they do acclimate along the way, people that climb the Alps and so forth have to be very, very, very careful, because one characteristic of altitude sickness, besides the fact that you don't have near as much oxygen in the air, fluids filling into the lungs. That's what will kill them, is edema and the fluid filling in the lungs. And they, what little oxygen there is, they have trouble even getting in, and so forth. So yeah, there are different conditions that can affect this. Any other comments or? Yeah. Capabilities. Some people can hold their breath longer than others. It kind of has to do with your breathing reflex. And it's like, how much CO2 buildup can you stand in your blood before you just got to take that breath and get it out. Now, let's talk about exercise a little bit more. So, we've seen that in the lungs, there is a pretty constant environment in there. What's going on in the tissue itself, the active tissue, the muscle? Because when a muscle is active, we want to be able to supply as much oxygen as we can to it. Now, there are two things that happen, well, lots of things that happen, but two things I want to focus on that happen in an active muscle. Okay, when you go out and exercise, what happens to your body temperature? Active muscle. They get warm, right? You warm up, you sweat, you do whatever. So one thing that happens in active muscle is the temperature goes up. Another thing that happens in active muscle, especially in individuals that are in worse shape than others, is that you begin, if you're not getting enough oxygen delivered to the muscle, you'll go into oxygen debt and you'll start producing lactic acid. You'll also produce more CO2. So typically in an active muscle, we'll see that the acidity of that active muscle increases a little bit due to CO2 production, due to lactic acid production that may be happening. Okay? Raise the temperature, raise the lower the pH, raise the acidity. Now, I want you to take a look at these other two graphs that we have at the bottom of page 39. So, this solid line right here is our kind of our standard oxygen hemoglobin association curve. We're going to talk about this other one later on. We'll worry about that one. What I want to focus on is these little insets here. So, experiments have been done. First of all, at different temperatures. Okay, so here's the first little inset. This is 38 degrees. Pretty much body temperature. Okay, so there's what we've been looking at. There's that graph. When you heat the hemoglobin up a little bit, you notice it changes the shape of the graph. It goes over here. Now, what does that mean at 43 degrees? Well, I don't know if you can take a muscle at 43 degrees, but at 43 degrees, if we were at that temperature, let's take a look at the relationship between the PO2 and the percent saturation again. Let's look at the 40 millimeter level we looked at before. So it's right here. So if we were to take our line up like this and connect it over, yes. What's that? Not a chance, I'm sorry. So all I'm doing is I'm going up at 40, and I'm just, what I want to know is what's the percent saturation? Okay? And you can do it on your own graphs. You've got them. You can do the same thing there. The point that I want to make is going to be pretty obvious. At 38 degrees, we look over here, according to this graph, this experiment, we'd be at about 65% saturation. At 43 degrees, we'd be at a little over 30% saturation. Now, what does that mean? That means as the temperature's gone up, the hemoglobin is giving off more oxygen.
Which is real adaptive, as that hemoglobin is going through the muscle and the muscle's getting warmer, that means the hemoglobin is going to be delivering even more oxygen to that muscle to help you keep from going into oxygen depth. So it's not bringing back, it's not reserving as much oxygen under those conditions. Very, very adaptive. Give off more oxygen. That's important. And we see a similar thing with pH. Now remember, I told you active muscle, the pH is likely to go down. The acidity is likely to go up because of CO2 and lactic acid. So we say the same thing here if we were to go up with the 40 level again. And compare normal acidity to high acidity. They conveniently didn't tell us how high acidity is. But again, you can see that difference. As the acidity goes up, the hemoglobin gives off more oxygen also. Acidity going up would be an indication of activity of the muscle. All right, so both of these, where that curve is actually shifting to the right, it's moving over in this direction. Both of those would serve to actually deliver more oxygen to your active muscle than it would get if it were still at normal temperature, if it were still at normal acidity. That's called the Bohr effect. And it's just the response of hemoglobin to these different conditions. So the point I'm trying to make here is we're really well adapted to utilize the oxygen that's available in the lungs. We're really well adapted to deliver that oxygen to our tissues. If we're delivering that oxygen to a working muscle where it needs more oxygen, we're really well adapted to even deliver more of that oxygen to that working muscle and so forth. All of those homeostatic kinds of things. We want to maintain oxygen levels in the muscle. We want to make it so that there's enough oxygen in the alveolar air and so forth. So all of those very, very adaptive things for us.
Okay, any questions about the Bohr effect? Yes. Temperature,
normal temperature. There's a lot more oxygen on that hemoglobin. So this scale here, they didn't bother to put in the scale. This would be the percent saturation hemoglobin. And so that hemoglobin has a lot more oxygen on it at normal temperature compared to higher temperature. That's the whole point of that graph. And so that's delivering more oxygen to that active muscle. That's ordinarily the problem. And that's what you want. You need more oxygen. And the second one with acidity down here is the same way under normal acidity conditions that hemoglobin is leaving that muscle with a greater percent saturation, which means that as we raise the acidity, that hemoglobin is leaving more oxygen again. And that would help to at least prevent as much lactic acid formation. Because when you're working really hard, if you go into oxygen debt, you start to form lactic acid, that's going to affect your ability of your muscles to contract and so forth. So you want to avoid that if you can. So this allows more oxygen to be left off under those conditions to hopefully avoid that. Doesn't mean you're going to prevent it, but it just means that we're going to get more benefit from the oxygen that's on the hemoglobin. Okay? They're just trends to look at, just things that we do. Now, we've already talked a little bit about altitude. Let's take another look at altitude. So you've got that graph on page 40. Why is it that when you go up in altitude, it just gets harder to breathe, so to speak? Coming from sea level to Ashland, no big deal. Going from sea level to, say, a mile in elevation, 5,280 feet, if you go out and exercise strenuously, I can almost guarantee you feel it a little bit. You're just not going to be able to do what you could. If you live at sea level and you go up to 10,000 feet and you go out and try to do normal exercise, for some people, even walking at that elevation is difficult. And I think I mentioned earlier that I had been up to 14,000 feet one time at the top of one of the volcanoes in Hawaii. And you can go out and try to do a little jog around the roads there. I would highly recommend it. But you'll fatigue fairly easily, and some people will really be affected by that. So what's going on with elevation? And so we've got this graph that shows the relationship between elevation, altitude, okay, elevation, and air pressure. So here we are, 760 millimeters down at sea level, right? And you can see that as we go up in elevation, the pressure goes down. And we've talked about that again, is because you have less of that air column pushing down on you as you go up in elevation, right? And so there's less and less pressure. Now, we would assume that the composition of the gas isn't going to change. That's not going to be any different. What's changing is the pressure of the gas. So we can use a graph like this. Okay. This is the one I wanted. Why didn't this make it into your lecture notes? That's what I want to know. Mine has a little more detail on it. Look what happens. So here's Mount Whitney. Okay, elevation just under 5,000 meters. The air pressure at the top of Mount Whitney, about 400 millimeters mercury rather than the 760. Okay, down here. Let me just read off a few of these things since this didn't make it into your lecture notes. So 8,000 feet is the altitude above which commercial aircraft pressurize the cabins. Why do they do that?
because the air pressure is lower, right? So they're going to pressurize the cabin. 16,732 feet altitude of the highest elevation for a continuously occupied city. So there's a city in Peru that sits at almost 17,000 feet. So that's right here, okay, that's continuously occupied. So you can adapt to that. Some people can at least adapt to that kind of an elevation. 29,000 feet right here, top of Mount Everest. The highest altitude for humans without oxygen, without carrying supplemental oxygen. And for people that climb Mount Everest, there are some Sherpas that can go to the top without carrying supplemental oxygen. But they're kind of rare, and I can almost guarantee you any of the mountain climbers that are paying them to take them up there are carrying some oxygen bottles with them in order to compensate for the altitude. Look at that. They're down to about, 220 maybe millimeters mercury of total atmospheric pressure. 40,000 feet, wherever that appears on there, is the maximum cruising altitude for most commercial air travel. So that's probably around here somewhere. This point, highest altitude for humans on pure oxygen. Breathing on pure oxygen. And then it goes up from there. I like this. 62 to 63,500 feet is the altitude at which water boils at normal body temperature. Think about that. Water boils at normal body temperature. What's going to happen to your body fluids? Not a pretty sight. So that's the effect there. So, okay, just going to take a few minutes to do this. It's time to get you back into small groups again. You haven't done this in a while. So groups of 3 to 5. Here's your assignment. So people often have a difficult time exercising higher altitudes, blah, 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 14,000 feet, really high. Average barometric pressure at 14,000 feet is about 430 millimeters. Okay, here's your assignment. Assuming the air is about 21% oxygen, what's the PO2 at 14,000 feet? The PO2. Assuming the alveolar air is similar in composition there as sea level, about 13.2% oxygen, what's the alveolar PO2 at that elevation? And then you can read the other questions, explain why, and so forth. So let's take just a few minutes, maybe 6 or 7 minutes. When you get done with this, if you take a break, just go ahead and do what you need to do, stand up, do jumping jacks, whatever, and then we'll get back together. Okay, let's talk about the answers that you came up with. So for the first question, assuming air is 21% oxygen, what's the PO2 at 14,000 feet? What, do you remember what you got? Say that twice. How do we compute that? Exactly. But here's the key to the whole thing, right? You don't multiply by 21%, right? You multiply it by 0.21. Yeah. I say that because there are probably a few people in here that made that mistake. So you always, if you're using a percent, you're always going to move it to the decimal equivalent, 0.21. So the answer would have been about 90.3. Remember at sea level it was 157, right? Up here it's 90.3. That's a pretty dramatic difference. What was the alveolar PO2? So there we're assuming that we've got the same thing going on, right? So we've only got 13.2% instead. So you do that multiplication again, and you'd see that the alveolar PO2 is about 57. Right, so that's what you're working with. That's what you've got to work with. Rather than the 100, you've got the 57 to work with. Now, the third question, explain in terms of oxygen delivery to muscles why a person would fatigue quickly. So you can look at this and say, okay, 57. You can look here, okay, there's a 60 line, so we're going to say, oh, look at that. You still got about 90% saturation of the hemoglobin. You don't get 100% saturated hemoglobin by any means, but you still get a fairly high saturation of the hemoglobin, but that's enough to notice. So if you're going out and if you're putting, so at 14,000 feet, if you're just walking along slowly, you may not notice so much. Although people that have breathing problems can really notice that. Some we talked about earlier. But if you were in good health and stuff, you at 14,000 feet, you probably wouldn't notice too much as long as you weren't up there for too long. But it will affect people, especially if you go out touch with ball game at that altitude. I'd love to watch that. There's less oxygen in the system, right? So that's why it affects us. Now, blood doping. Blood doping, the original blood doping, and the term blood doping has now been kind of broadened. But the original blood doping was the removal of blood from an individual, concentrating the red blood cells right before the event, putting the red cells back in to the body. There's always a risk every time you do a transfusion like that, raw blood, put blood back in and so forth. So people from the get-go didn't like that idea, except the athletes that were benefiting from it. How is blood doping expected to help? Why would that help an athlete's performance by doing that? Because you're increasing what? Exactly. You're increasing the number of red blood cells. That means you're increasing the amount of hemoglobin. That means you can carry that much more oxygen in the body. That was the whole idea behind that. What they're doing now, as I said, the definition kind of shifted. And we're going to talk, it's not going to be till next time now, but we're going to talk about erythropoietin again. That's a hormone that we talked about back when we were looking at the circulatory system. And now it's kind of erythropoietin injections that stimulates your production of red blood cells. It's like going up to altitude and staying for a while, except you're injecting the hormone into your body to increase the number of red blood cells. Some dangers in that, like if you get too many red blood cells, your blood can get too thick. You can have all sorts of problems with that. So it's a no-no. Good. Okay, very good. So now, we've talked about hemoglobin. I want to talk with you a little bit about the second respiratory pigment, myoglobin. Where did you go, myoglobin? Why are you there? Okay, forget myoglobin for a minute. We'll talk about carbon dioxide, and then we'll talk about myoglobin. So, that tells us how oxygen is carried in the blood. Now the next question that we've got is, how is carbon dioxide carrying the blood? Okay, and there's not a comparable system for carrying carbon dioxide in the blood to what we've looked at for oxygen. There's no respiratory pigment, so to speak, that's going to pick up the carbon dioxide and circulating it. So actually, three ways that carbon dioxide gets carried in the blood. Okay, three different ways. The first is kind of a non-specific attraction to hemoglobin. So there are certain amino acids on the hemoglobin molecule that the carbon dioxide will bind to. And so the hemoglobin can pick up some carbon dioxide that way, but it's not like the hemoglobin. There's no association curve or anything like that that goes on there. So kind of a non-specific non-specific connection to certain amino acids of the hemoglobin. So that's going to carry some of it. And it's estimated that maybe as much as 25% of the carbon dioxide gets carried that way. The lion's share of carbon dioxide gets carried in the blood as the bicarbonate ion. And this is about 65% of the CO2. It's the bicarbonate ion. And we'll talk in a minute how the rest of it's going to be carried as CO2 gas in the plasma, just like oxygen can dissolve in the blood plasma, CO2 can dissolve there too. But if we can figure out a way to kind of get rid of that CO2 that's in the plasma, if we can convert it into something else, then we can carry more of it. So it's just like what we did, again, what we did with the glucose and the glycogen. It's like what we did with the oxygen and loading onto the hemoglobin. This time, it says a bicarbonate ion. What happens is that carbon dioxide will react with water to form an acid we call carbonic acid. Okay, carbonic acid. I'm running out of pen options here. I'm not seeing any good ones right now. Smearing everywhere. Okay, carbonic acid. That carbonic acid, it's an acid, so it's going to give off a hydrogen ion. So it will ionize. So there's the hydrogen ion plus the bicarbonate ion, which is HCO3 right here. Sodium bicarbonate. Okay, common thing, baking soda or something. That's the active ingredient there. The bicarbonate ion, carbonate, carbonic acid, bicarbonate ion. And that's, so that reaction scheme, CO2 will bind with the oxygen, form the acid, the oxygen will ionize, and we've got this bicarbonate ion that's circulating around. So it's in essence removing the CO2 out of the plasma so more CO2 can come in and this can continue. Now, obviously, if this continues for very long, it's going to affect the pH of the blood. And we've talked last term about how there are these chemicals in the body, in the blood, that tend to reverse pH changes. So the blood is, remember, those were called buffers. The blood is highly buffered to prevent significant pH changes. So to prevent those hydrogen ions from accumulating too much and causing mischief. Now, what happens when we get to the lungs? Okay, so we got that blood coming in from the lungs, PCO2 of about 45. We know that CO2 is going to start moving into the lungs because the CO2 in the lungs is lower than in the blood. So as the level of CO2 in the plasma goes down, then this whole thing is going to go in reverse. So the bicarbonate ions will pick up hydrogen ions, reforming the carbonic acid. The carbonic acid will break apart into the water and the CO2 again, and then that CO2 will go ahead and move out of the blood into the lungs. So that's the primary means by which we carry CO2. Some of it attached to the hemoglobin, most of it like this. And then the third was just CO2 gas in the blood plasma. And it's estimated that, what do we got, about 10% of the CO2 is going to be carried as CO2 gas in the blood plasma. So that's how we're getting rid of that CO2. We're collecting it up from the body and carrying it into the alveoli and off-gassing it into the alveoli. Now, if we were to summarize that, let me just draw a summary diagram there, the bottom half of page 41, if you manage to not fill that up. Looking for another pin that I'm not finding. So again, this is our lungs. This is just not good. That's an alveolus, right? Like we had before. And here's our circulatory system. So I'm just going to draw big vessels and little vessels. So here we have the capillary going around. Big vessel becomes little vessel, becomes big vessel. So blood's going to come in here, go out here. We talked about how the PO2 of the alveolar air was 100 millimeters mercury, PCO2 40 millimeters mercury. We talked about how blood coming into this environment, PO2 was 40, and the PCO2 is 45. So that's the blood coming in. We talked about how the oxygen then, because we got more oxygen in here, oxygen's going to diffuse into the blood. We talked about the CO2. It's going to diffuse out of the blood in this direction. And so that the gas, the blood leaving the lungs was equilibrated with the air in the alveolus. So PO2 of 100, PCO2 of 40. So we've gotten the oxygen, we've gotten rid of the CO2. Now, we're going to take this out to the body tissues. Okay, so here's where we're going to add. So we're going to go out through our circulatory route. And this is going to be very, very stylized, okay? So we're going to, but we're going to get into the capillary beds. Capillary beds in the body. You know, is it in muscle? Is it in your stomach, your gut? Is it in your brain? Where is it? So we're in the capillary beds again. And so in our tissues, because we're utilizing the oxygen. If the oxygen is coming back as a PO2 of 40, then that tells us that the tissues are running around a PO2 of 40. This is painful. Let me try this pen that never has been working. Okay, PO2 of 40, PCO2 of 45. So we're going to have oxygen diffusing out into the tissues, right? We're going to have CO2 then diffusing in, so we're now picking that up, and then we're going to just circulate that back through the heart, back to the lungs again. So we're we've got this this big cycle that's going on, this route. Gas exchange in the lungs, heart sends that to the body, gas exchange in the tissues through the capillary beds, bring that back, recycle, just restock the oxygen, get rid of the CO2 we picked up, and just keep running around like that. So that's kind of what's going on there with the two. And we talked about the different means by which we're carrying the oxygen and the CO2 in order to make that happen. So that's just kind of a summary of what we've been talking about here. Okay? So, now, let's talk about a few other things. Let's talk about myoglobin. So myoglobin was the other respiratory pigment. Remember I told you that we will use myoglobin to store oxygen in the muscle. And this is important if you just need a shot of something to get things going and so forth. You're going to just immediately go from rest to active, that flight or fight response and so forth. It would be very helpful to have a shot of oxygen to go along with it, so that you don't have an oxygen tank. So if you look at page 42, you've got this graph that compares the oxygen association-dissociation curve for hemoglobin and myoglobin. And you can see that there are two different ones. So remember, the hemoglobin could carry four oxygen molecules at a time. And that the myoglobin is a much simpler structure. It can only carry a single. It can only store away a single oxygen molecule. And that's in part why you get a different shape. So there's the curve that we've been looking at for hemoglobin. There's the curve for myoglobin. Now remember, myoglobin's sitting in the muscle, it's storing oxygen away. So if we're going to store oxygen away, we really don't want it to get used too fast. We want that to be reserved. Let the hemoglobin do most of the supplying, but if we really need that reserve, we'd like to have it there. So watch. Myoglobin at PO2 of about 100 right here. Myoglobin, whereas the hemoglobin is 100% saturated, myoglobin is about 95% saturated. And it's leveled off at that point, so you're not going to get it all saturated. We talked about the blood maybe flowing through the tissue at rest. Tissue has a PO2 of about 40. We talked about how with the hemoglobin coming back to the lungs, that means that it's about 75% saturated. Look at the myoglobin. At a PO2 of 40, it's still about 90% saturated. So we can actually pick up some oxygen from the hemoglobin as it's going through the tissue. We talked about how when that muscle gets active, this is going to start to drop. The PO2 is going to start to drop because we're using a lot more oxygen at that point. And so it's going to drop. Let's go down to 20. Okay, here's the 20 line. Here's 20. Here's 20 up here. Okay. The hemoglobin is going to offload a whole bunch of its oxygen going from 40 to 20. So if that muscle gets really active. The myoglobin was at about 90, it's down to about 75. So it's been able to contribute some oxygen to that tissue also. But the real bonus for myoglobin is that that oxygen drops even further, because look at how that drops off. Within, from 0 to 20, we can go from 75% saturated on the myoglobin to 0% saturated. So that's where it's really going to give up that oxygen and hopefully help that tissue, prevent that tissue from going into oxygen debt. You can't completely stop that, but that's providing that extra boost of oxygen to make available. But yeah, question?
No, I don't.
It's
much, much more hemoglobin than myoglobin is in all of our blood. I don't know what percent protein in muscle is myoglobin. It's going to be a fairly small percent. So it's an important factor, but it's not going to provide oxygen for a very long period of time. Okay, but just differences in the way these molecules pick up what it is that they're picking up. So myoglobin allows us to store some oxygen in the muscle for emergencies. Now, let's talk about carbon monoxide. You know that if you're in an environment that's rich in carbon monoxide, what does it do? Carbon monoxide asphyxiation. What's the carbon monoxide doing? What it's doing is the carbon monoxide binds to the iron on the hemoglobin. So basically, the carbon monoxide displaces the oxygen. And the more carbon monoxide you have, the longer you have that circulating in, it's going to be picked up from the lungs, and it's going to preferentially bind to the hemoglobin on the to the iron on the hemoglobin. So you're carrying less and less oxygen. And one of the problems with carbon monoxide is that once it gets bound to the hemoglobin, it's hard to get rid of. So it binds fairly tightly to the hemoglobin. And actually, the best way to help someone if you suspect carbon monoxide poisoning is to obviously get them into fresh air, but also get them into light, because light tends to break that bond. It'll help to break that bond between the carbon monoxide and the hemoglobin, so that you can begin to unload oxygen and hopefully get the carbon monoxide moving out of the lungs, because you're no longer in the carbon monoxide environment. One of the great ironies with carbon monoxide is that you know how blood, when it's oxygenated, is a red, nice red color? Blood that has carbon monoxide on it is even a nicer red color. So you'd look at their blood and you say, what's the problem? You know, it's nice and red, there shouldn't be a problem. Well, you can't identify carbon monoxide poisoning that way. So you'd think that they should be fine, but they're not. So that's what carbon monoxide does. Two things and then I'll let you go. I'm going to finish. I've got about probably 5 or 10 minutes more to talk with you about on this. And we'll talk about the mechanism of breathing and stuff next time. That sheet that I had you pick up today, be sure you bring it next time. We'll get around to it next time. So that's about it. Hope you all have a great weekend.
See you all next week.